So I'm just going to say I'm Jesse Wilkerson here with Lucy Hennigan on May 21st, 2010. And Lucy is going to begin by telling me about her childhood.
So okay.
Continue.
Well, I grew up in a little town called Oskaloosa in Kansas, where my parents did research in this town. My father was a psychologist, and they had a research station there, and they also lived in this town. And it, you know, in a little way, it was a good place to grow up in most ways, but we weren't typical of people there, I can put it that way. And my parents felt they couldn't do a lot to influence the town because they were studying it, you know. But after the research quit, then my mother got very active in improving the town. But it was a good place, and we certainly were accepted and all. However, I have to say that, you know, things like the schools weren't great, and there were no cultural advantages there. It's a town of 900 people, so it had some other advantages.
Mm-hmm.
But I went from there to Oberlin, which was a huge step. And I always have thought I got into Oberlin because they were so excited to have somebody from Kansas apply. Oberlin was certainly a real eye-opener to me, and I just met so many different people. And I became really aware about the civil rights issues all of a sudden.
What year did you enter?
So it was 61, the fall of 61. And, you know, it all gets a little vague in my mind about what happened, but I ended up, I mean, people, you know, it was the time people were starting to go to the South to intervene in the civil rights issues, and I didn't feel comfortable doing that, but I felt very concerned about what was going on, and I went to summer school at Tougaloo College near Jackson, Mississippi, and it's a small. At that point, it was almost all black school, with a lot of white teachers, however. I liked it. It was interesting. I felt comfortable there, and I ended up staying the whole next year at Tougaloo. I kept making the decisions each semester and stayed on, and ironically, it cost me not being able to have quite enough credits to graduate when I was supposed to, so I had to take a summer school class. So I didn't go to graduation, and Martin Luther King talked to our graduating class, but I wasn't there. Anyway. And the rest of my time at Oberlin, I continued to be active in a group that promoted the exchanges with Tougaloo and also with a white college in Birmingham called Birmingham Southern. And I visited there at some point, I remember. But this was all a feeling on my part, I think, that we all had to understand more and had to have better communication with everybody.
So how many white students were at Tougaloo when you were there?
Oh, three or four. Three,
so what
I can
was,
think of.
What was that experience like?
Or maybe two. Well, people were real nice. I mean, they were awfully. I think it must have been very weird for them. And there's a book that a person who was there at that time named Ann Moody wrote, and it's called Coming of Age in Mississippi. And I reread it, some of it just recently, after reading The Help, which is about that exact time. Because it was, I wanted to, I knew that what The Help said wasn't my experience in Mississippi. And Moody talks about being she transferred from a state school. And if she mentions another of the white women who were there, and I know, and for what she said, it was weird. It was a new experience for her to have white people she could trust. Mm-hmm. There was a white teacher named Ernst Berinsky who taught social studies, and he had what he called a lab in a basement of a building, and it was a place people could just went and to hang out, I think, in retrospect. I don't, or maybe they went to study, but I don't know what else it would be. That was important. And then at that time there were beginning to be some rallies, and people went from there and did some voting rights work, and there was this newspaper that I went and helped some called the Mississippi Free Press, and its editor was this guy from Oberlin. Biggs was his name, I think. But I played a lot of cards there at Tougaloo. I learned to play whist. And I seemed to be able to do that kind of thing and fit in a social way, but at least I fit in at some level. Clearly I can't have been just completely open with me. Mm-hmm. But I was in a room with two women who were sisters who were my roommates.
Did you stay in touch with people from
I haven't. I feel bad that I haven't, and nor have I ever been back. I think I should do that. Mm-hmm. No.
And did you get involved in activism? So you said you didn't want to go into doing activist work. You went to the college.
Right, right.
Did that then introduce you to activism, or were you more committed to the social?
Not a lot. I mean, at Oberlin there was always activism going on, so you always were involved at some level. And when I was at Tougaloo, I just worked on that paper. Mm-hmm. And attended some meetings that were at Tougaloo. I don't think I went off campus to meetings. This, you can imagine, was pretty scary to my parents. But they were good. They were good. Mm-hmm. They didn't express that to me. Other people have said that to me since then. You know how hard that was on your parents, Mm-hmm. So I guess from Oberlin I had worked a couple of summers in Nashville, and at that time I did go to some things at the college. There were some rallies and things. It was very weird. This summer after I was at Tougaloo, I worked in Nashville in a child development program, mm-hmm. and I stayed in a dorm with white young women. That was just really, really weird, because they had no idea what I had just done. I mean, I did not say anything. And
so these were white women who...
who were probably pretty racist people, I mean, I can't remember any details except feeling that I'm feeling really out of place. Mm-hmm. The next summer I stayed in a house with some people, and that was fine. But that's where I did this. It was a kind of an early intervention program with young children, with a kind of pre-Head Start. And so that kind of was a background from my work I've done later with young kids, so it all fits in. Mm-hmm. But from Oberlin, I went to Bank Street College in New York City, which is a college of education. And I took enough credits to get a teaching certificate, but I didn't finish. I didn't get a master's. And I think I shouldn't have done that, because I just, all of a sudden, when they were much more lax than I felt they were at Oberlin, and when people weren't holding a grade over my head, I just didn't do all the work. Mm-hmm. Anyway, because I had to go back another one summer, a few years later, and finish something up. But I did it. And it was, I mean, it's a great school. It was a good school, and I lived. It was fun to live in New York. But upon finishing that, I had to do something. I had to get a job. And I had, in Nashville, I had met a woman, and lived with a woman who was teaching at Pine Mountain Settlement School in Harlan County. So I applied to Harlan County, and I got a job as a reading teacher. And so I went there just knowing nothing mm-hmm. about Appalachia, really. It was really exciting, I have to say. And are you at all familiar with Pine Mountain?
I am a little bit. I've read David Wisnett's.
It is just a gorgeous place. It was a gorgeous place then. I think it's less, I mean, the environment has been more strip mined around it, not at mm-hmm. it. But and it's so remote. My parents drove me there, you know, which was a real experience, an eye-opener to them.
So what was the school like during that time?
Well, it was a county elementary school then, and Pine Mountain has beautiful buildings, just an open setting, you know, lovely things wherever you look, and they're log buildings, they're old buildings, they're nice, were nicely maintained. But it was a county school system, and so you had all that to deal with. And I taught reading to small groups of kids. And I hadn't any particular experience in this, but it wasn't hard to do. It was fun to do. I did a lot of things like having them write stories and illustrate stories and. Put on little shows and stuff, you know. This is not just all literacy, whatever you did. And I lived with two other women in a house, and that was nice. And we went on adventures driving around.
Teachers?
Pardon?
Were they two other teachers?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they are people, well, one of them particularly is somebody has been a good friend all these years. It was the era they still did, paddling and all that. And I didn't have to do that because I just had five kids or something, but it happened to other people. Mm-hmm. And I learned, I'm interested in crafts, so you go and see this wonderful basket maker or this wonderful woman who makes dolls, corn shuck dolls. Mm-hmm. So it was great, in lots of ways. It was really neat. The second year I was there, I taught at Pine Mountain half time and at another school down the road, Straight Creek, half the time. And that was a building that was just one-room schools pushed together, literally pushed together. So, you'd walk up these steps and open this door and be in this room, or then you'd go out and walk up these steps and go in and be in another room. There was no connection between them. And each of these rooms had a stove in it, a popular stove, which you had to keep going. And the teacher next door to me was a new teacher, and she paddled the kids so much. Mm. And I mean, the first few times it just made my stomach go, ugh! When it happened, I'm afraid that I got immune to it after a while. But as I recall, that teaching was okay for me too. I don't really remember it as much as the kids at Pine Mountain.
Were most of the teachers people who were coming from outside of?
Well, there were there weren't too many teachers. Also, there was not very big. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of people I can think of that were local people or pretty local people. But maybe I can think of, you know, five or six that weren't. Mm-hmm. But the getting to know the people that lived there, it was just wonderful. I can remember going with Connie, and I don't know if Toppy went, to a family for dinner. You know, we were invited for a dinner, and they had many children, and it's this, go up this little long, narrow road and up a holler, and there's a house on the side of the hill, and there was all this food. They'd made all this food, and they said, you know, then we sat down and ate, and then we were done, and then somebody else sat down and ate until the end, when the children got to sit down and eat. I mean, and there wasn't room for everyone. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we were the first, probably we and the father.
Mm-hmm.
People were very open and friendly to the teachers from Pine Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're quite appreciative of them. Anyway, I remember that time very fondly.
What years were?
So this would, I was in New York 65 and 66, so it was 66 to 68.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't exactly remember why I left there. I don't know if Connie also left there that year. She had been there the year. She and Toppy had been there the year before as well.
And are those the women you lived with?
Uh-huh. Then I kind of beat around a little bit. I went to Nashville. I stayed with friends. I drove a bus for a preschool program from Peabody. And then I met Brenda at some point. I can figure out the date of this. I met Brenda. We worked one Christmas at a bookstore. It turned out she had met my brother in Peace Corps training. And anyway, so we became friends. And then I think the next fall, and also that, well, I'm missing a year. But then we made plans to live in a house together.
Did you meet Rich?
I met Rich. Then I met Rich because, golly, there was a year I lived with Kathy Hudson, who was a member of Focus. And it was through Kathy. Kathy was there getting a master's in speech. And I guess I knew Kathy from my driving around when I was at Pine Mountain. You know, it's not too far. It's over a mountain or so.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big stone from Pine Mountain. And so she knew Rich. Rich was down doing his alternative service. And I went with her for Thanksgiving up to Big Stone, and that's where I met Rich. And then he came down, he and some other people came down and visited Kathy a time or two, and we continued our acquaintance. And then the next year, we moved in together. So, and I think living together in that group, and living, and Rich also, certainly, but and meeting Brenda, then later meeting Fran, was an eye-opener to me about women's issues. I don't think I'd really thought it had anything to do with me much. You know, I'd certainly heard about it, but I feel I was, you know, I had any problems.
So can you describe that process?
Of how
moving in with them and meeting other women like Fran and Brenda led you to different ideas about women's issues? What sorts of things were going on that made you think that you had a different relationship to it than you thought?
Oh, I don't know if I can. It's a long time ago. But I certainly would give them credit. I mean, they were, well, Brenda at that point in time was working at Motive, and I mean, I think I was exposed to just many, I mean, at Oberlin I had to have been exposed to some of these ideas as well, but I did belong to a consciousness-raising group there that Brenda's sister was in, and some other people.
Is this Marcia?
Marcia, right.
I'm talking to her tomorrow, too.
Are you? Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe she'll remember more about this group than I do. But we did meet, and I'm sorry, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. At that time, did you also have meetings with your partners, your male partners? I know that happened later. I'm not sure if you were a part of it, but mixed gender political discussion meetings?
Well, I don't know that we had anything formal, but living in that house, we had many, many discussions, because there everybody was very interested, and it was a very interesting time.
So what led you all to live together?
Well, I don't know, you know. I was thinking, you know, I had this assumption when Rich and I started to feel like we were in love, that I said, okay, we'll get married, and Rich said, well, I think he was the person that had more open-minded ideas. I mean, I don't think I expressed this, but I just assumed it, you know, that that's the course of things. And then it turned out that, no, we would live in this group house for a while. And it was great, you know. And once I had this idea, I mean, I wasn't at all disappointed. It's funny, I didn't feel chipped, or it was good. So I think it would be interesting if Brenda remembers. It was Brenda and I and Ed, and then Connie. Connie is my friend from Pine Mountain. So she and the person she married, they initially lived there. Then the next year, Fran and Jim lived there in their room. Mm-hmm. So we were a veteran house of a year when they came. And a woman, you know, Joan of Europe, Joan Boyd, she lived there. She lives in Big Stone. I bet Ed and Brenda hatched up this plan.
They had known each other a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very organized house in that we had work charts and schedules and all this, and house meetings.
Mm-hmm. who first set up all of the structure?
Well, I'd say we all did. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ed was a very structured person, so he probably, Brenda and I moved in and were setting things up when I had this accident in which a cabinet, a big, heavy wooden cabinet in the kitchen in which we were putting things fell off the wall slowly, you know. But it was just turned out to be nailed up with big nails, which is not a good idea. But its fall was blocked by a cabinet. So it could have been worse, but I did get cut, and I still have a scar here, and I have a scar here. That scar is from this scar. It's from a cut because there were jars that broke, and Brenda, we were right about 2 blocks from the hospital. This was Andy. She took me to the hospital, but I went in there reeking of vinegar and cloves and pickle juice and everything. It was quite funny. Anyway, that was one. I think that's when I got to thinking more about fairness to gay people, because one of Brenda's co-workers was a gay woman. And also a male friend worked there was mm-hmm. with her. So that, I mean, it was a very growing kind of time. You know, you can see, you know, in looking back at how important all these different stages were in kind of opening up my ideas.
Mm-hmm. What led the group living to come to an end?
Well, Fran and Jim wanted to move over here and start whatever that organization, that higher education thing was. Mm-hmm. He did. Because they had come, as you probably know or will know, they had come to kind of figure out what to do in the South. And Joe and Brenda moved over, had decided to move over here, and I'm not positive what their reasoning was now. And Rich had finished, had done a master's in how he managed to do his conscientious objection second year being a student, getting a master's in psychology. At Peabody, so that was over, you know, and he had decided to go to nursing school, and I don't, you know, why we decided to do what we did, so I don't know, you know, so he went to Harlan, and I got a job up in Wise County, Kentucky, Virginia. So I don't know how that all came about, but it certainly did, and it was a plan.
Mm-hmm.
But mainly, I think it broke up because people were ready to go do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And we have realized that this fall or end of summer is the 40th year since we moved in together. So we'll have to get together.
So can we go back a little bit to your Pine Mountain experience? I'm curious as to how you felt going from your experience, even if you weren't directly involved in some of the civil rights activism? I mean, it sounds like moving to a college, you know, a black college, and being a white woman is a pretty big deal.
Right, I know it was.
Yeah.
It was.
So doing that, and then, you know, being from Kansas in the first place, and then going to the mountains where you had what I imagine was a sort of poverty with white people that was, I imagine, a newer experience. So, you know, what was that like? How did you kind of see those things as tying together or not fitting together? Mm-hmm. How do you explain those experiences?
Well, one thing, this is not exactly answering that, but one thing that I think helped me be able to do both those things is growing up where I did, because the one thing we had to do in Oskaloosa was fit in. And I mean, partly it's my personality also that, you know, is sort of, I'm not a pushy person, and I wait and see and wait till somebody's ready to open up to me and that kind of thing. So I think that enabled me to manage okay at Tougaloo, and I think it also is skillful anywhere you go. I think it has helped me anyway. There are certainly other ways to be, but I think, and also I think all through my life I've been taught to be respectful of other people and the way they are in their cultures. And so I think whether it's living in a small town in Oskaloosa or at Tougaloo or in Harlan County, it's the same thing. It's the same. Well, one thing that did happen at Tougaloo, and I want to ask Connie what she remembers about this, but we at some point felt that the people that were running Pine Mountain were not being kind of inclusive enough with local people who were involved in Pine Mountain. And I remember we wrote a letter about this saying, we thought this was wrong in some way, you know. Mm-hmm. So clearly, I had this idea of, that I couldn't get rid of people being kind of in charge of their lives. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have to give Oberlin a credit. Oberlin is just full of all kinds of activism. Really is a hotbed of it, and in a very good way,
mm-hmm.
an eye-opening place. I think after I left Kentucky, and then for, you know, these years I kind of wandered around. I wasn't focused. I did little jobs. I did weaving for a while, which I didn't mention. I did that when we lived together. We had a loom in the dining room. I don't know. I think that's a lot of people go through times of not being focused, but it's kind of lasted a long time in my life,
mm-hmm.
in a way. But it's been okay. But it's not as if I decided I'd go get a law degree and help people like, you know, Fran has done.
But you did move back to. Were you living in Rich was working in Harlan, and you?
Yeah. Well, no. Then we moved we moved back, right? And we lived. It's just over a mountain from. We lived in Lee County, Virginia, and he had to drive over the mountain to Harlan. And I did work in that same kind of area. And and that is where, and we did help to organize this St. Charles Health Care Clinic. So we did
get involved locally with things that were going on. That was neat. That was neat. And I had a job. My job there was also a good job. I was a, I don't know what my title was, but anyway, I went to visit families with young children that were at risk for some bad thing, and visited them weekly with activities to do, which is about the same thing I just finished doing a year or so ago here.
Mm-hmm.
For a Tennessee organization, but so I got to travel around and go into people's homes and try to be useful to them. I also, in that program, you took them to appointments and stuff too as well. But I learned a lot and met people, and it was a good job. So I did that. Rich went to nursing school, and then he finished nursing school, and then he worked at a clinic over there. I think no. Then he worked at Big Stone, mm-hmm. in the hospital. Then we went back to Nashville for a year when he got his nurse practitioner training. At that point, we had a baby, right, or a little girl. So
can you tell me a little more about helping to organize the health clinic?
Right. Well, we went and talked to people. I mean, we did, and there was a woman who still is there named Beth. Sister Beth, she's a nun. I could probably dredge up her last name. She is a really remarkable woman. And she and another sister, and there may have been others, we went and talked to people that sort of, in this community of St. Charles, is a real coal mining community, and has lots of coal camps that kind of go out from it. And at that point, I think it still was, I'm not sure if it still was mining coal there or not, but it certainly was in a decline. So we talked to people, got them together, had meetings, made a health council. I was on the health council. Rachel was a baby, and she would come to health council meetings as a baby. That was neat. That was neat. The Vanderbilt, mm-hmm. health fair people came there. We had a health fair. And there's a health clinic. We established a health clinic. A health clinic got established, and it may have been established after we left. And it's still going. Art Van Zee has been the doctor there for decades, and he's should get a medal. So we lived there. So that, oh God, we lived there at some point after Rich came back from, and was a nurse practitioner, and then he worked at a clinic in Harlan County as a nurse practitioner. That must have not been for very long. We moved here when I was pregnant with my second child, and Rachel was two.
Mm-hmm. Did you stay in touch with people there?
I did. We did some. We did some for a while. And we are in touch somewhat with Art. See him now and then. But I'm not in touch
there's nobody local person I'm in touch with now. Mm-hmm. And we lived in a house initially that was a three-room house with an outhouse. So it was a three-room house arranged like this, like an L, and it had two porches and was heated with a coal stove. It had running, it had a sink, it had a drain, it didn't have running water. It had a spring, it had an outhouse, and it had a creek that went behind it. And it had these roses or something really pretty on it. And I thought it was just lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And later, you know, maybe 15 years ago or so, we went back and looked at it, and it was just a shack.
Oh.
But I think it really looked better when we lived there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it deteriorated over the years. It cost, the rent for that house was $15 a month.
Wow.
So we stayed there, and then when we were going to have a child, we moved into Pennington Gap in another very odd house, but it had a running water and it had a toilet in a bedroom. And its rent was $35 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe 30, and then we moved to another house. Anyway, in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So was
funny.
The clinic and I guess even this might go back to your experience at Pine Mountain Settlement School also, but those are the years the Appalachian Regional Commission was, you know, it's still mm-hmm. in existence, but I think more grounded in giving more money to communities and directly funding.
Right.
Like
well,
that.
I actually think, I bet the program I worked for was funded by them.
Mm-hmm.
It was from Dylan Owisco, and it was, you know, this early intervention program.
Mm-hmm.
So I bet a nickel it was.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew some, and we certainly knew people in that area who were like Beth Bingman and Rich Kirby and all the old Focus people. You know, they were all out hustling around trying to do good things.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a community of people that we knew that, you know, had the same kind of political outlook. And
mm-hmm. So did you interact often with those people?
Yeah. We certainly, we did. We did socially, and I think organizationally we were involved a lot with that health council, but for sure, yeah, and you know, it's, and we still know them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's really a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very glad about that.
Mm-hmm.
As well as being glad about our, you know, this group of friends around here. That has been super.
Mm-hmm. So when you were trying to make things, you know, start a health clinic and have meetings with community people, were there challenges that you remember from that?
I can remember I can't remember. I think it went pretty well as far as getting people involved and then getting something to happen. And I think Rich and I left
as I said, I think before the clinic actually happened. But I remember this was a kind of an eye-opener to both of us as organizers, not that we went on to do that much, but we both thought it would be better to scale down kind of the goal and get something less than a clinic, that it was just more realistic. But it was clear that, you know, what people wanted was a clinic, and that's what they would work for. Mm-hmm. And they were right. There's no question that the community needed one, but in an organizational way, it was also important for it to be a clinic.
Mm-hmm. So was that a discussion that you had with the group?
Yeah, I think we had that some, but clear, we were clear. It was clear that we were wrong, we're outvoted. Uh-huh. So it was not a big issue. Mm-hmm.
So did you see yourselves as part of a movement of people who were more educated and had moved around the country more? And some had joined things like VISTA and ended up in these little mountain towns in Appalachia. Was there a sense that you were a part of
that movement? Yes, I think so. Yes.
Was that a conscious thing at the time, or is it just kind of a reflection now?
I think it was conscious, and I think Rich went into healthcare because he thought it was an area that needed work done on it, you know, in that way. Oh, I think so.
Mm-hmm. And where is Rich from?
He grew up in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And I guess another question that comes up for me about those experiences that you had is that you were tapping into Pine Mountain, that the settlement school was associated with religious, but it wasn't earlier.
I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, there is certainly a chapel there, but it's mm-hmm. not a big deal. It was, you know, Eastern women who came down. Mm-hmm. And established a school, but I don't know that they were associated with a church.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the other part of that was, how did you meet the sisters who were working?
Well, Rich got there. I mean, Rich went there because he was a Catholic.
Okay.
And I think he had met, he'd gone on some trip down south that was an eye-opener for him earlier, and you know, he knew about them, so he was able to get in touch with them for this when he needed a conscientious, he was getting drafted. Mm-hmm. So that's how he got to them. So it was through his Catholicism, which then ran out pretty fast, I'd say, but and I just got to know them just because they were handy. Mm-hmm. You know, my family were Presbyterians, but religion has never been a very important part of my life.
Mm-hmm. So what? How did your experience living in this communal household with other activists, how do you think that influenced what you did later in moving to Southern Appalachia?
Well, in a way,
you know, I think we were going out from that house to do work in the real world. I think there was a little bit of that feeling, mm-hmm. As well as the feeling of kind of getting started on a marriage and all that. So we got married at that point, before we left Nashville. But it'd be interesting to talk with Brenda and Fran and Jim about that, mm-hmm. how they felt. I think Joe felt that way a bit. Because he went and then did work at Alcoa, which I think he thought of as being, you know, the place you should be with the workers, kind of. I think there was a bit of that, and I'm sure Rich felt that way. I was fortunate and got that job, which, you know. And then we did have the idea of the health clinic, mm-hmm. and that worked out.
Well, you said that you felt like Brenda and or being in the house, but I think you mentioned Brenda specifically, led you to start thinking more about women's issues.
Mm-hmm.
And can you give examples of how that influenced the way you lived your own life after leaving, like what impact that had on you?
Oh. I think just it just made me more aware, and I certainly was more able to pay better attention. You know, I worked with mothers and children mainly, who were not always very powerful people, you know, in their lives. So I had the role of trying to make them feel, give them skills to make them feel better at their jobs of being mothers. So I think I could think about what I was doing in a little bit more of a political way. I also learned to pay better attention, you know, to news and what was going on, and to read more things. And Rich, I have to say, he's always been a good influence in learning things.
How do you think, I mean, I guess the better question is, did you see yourself as part of a women's movement in the 70s?
I think so.
And what does that mean to you?
Well, I think it meant a great feeling of sisterhood with a lot of people, of sharing with things. One wonderful thing that happened after we lived here, and so we moved down here a lot because after having a child, we got to feeling more isolated there. And so we moved here because these people we knew lived around here. And Rich got a job. And then we started this wonderful thing called Mothers Meetings. Have you heard about them?
Briefly, yes.
So we'd meet Sunday mornings at someone's house, and this would be Fran and Brenda and I and maybe Marcia, Juliet, maybe.
Juliet Miff, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. But so several people. Oh, and then Gwen. I don't know how often we did this, but you know, we did it regularly for a lot of years. The children and the fathers would stay home. We'd get together and eat and talk about whatever. But you know, a lot of it involves mothering and children, but I don't expect it all did. And that was a great resource and a source of strength. And I would advise anybody having children to find such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know when it stopped.
So did it go on for years?
Some years.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think so.
And so what kind of, do you remember the types of things that would come up, or how, and also how the meetings were run? Like, was there a certain theme for each one, or was it just?
It was pretty informal, as I recall. And, and I think just people just talked about what was going on and what their kids were doing, and we compared notes, and our husbands, what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a great way to learn things and get some ideas, but also to feel a kinship with people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, still feel it. We still can get together. We still have children. They're just in their 30s now, so.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we're, I think all of us feel lucky. Lucky to have had this group of people that have, you know, have been friends. And you know, it's a few people, but then there are people beyond that that have also been supportive and that you know share a lot with you, and I think it's from doing a variety of different kind of work in this area for a lot of years that has made it happen and last. One other thing that did come out of, I think, was the Highlander Camp, Children's Camp, which for two summers we gathered and had kind of a few days of camping together. One year, or maybe both years, was at Fran's mother's place, and we planned activities for the kids and you know, did things together. And it was fun, and then we just thought, we should do more than this. Oh, somebody I haven't mentioned that was certainly involved in all these things was Polly Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's really Polly and Fran and I think, that thought, let's talk to Highlander about doing a camp at Highlander. So that started, and I got the job as the director for that. And Polly helped a lot of years, and Fran helped some, but Brenda did not get involved in that. I think she felt she couldn't help because of whatever she was doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. So was the camp for?
The camp was for our children and others, to provide them with a good experience of being exposed to what we thought they should be exposed to,
mm-hmm.
which they might not have been in their schools here, and try to get a diverse group of kids and counselors and stuff. It was for a week, and it's still going on.
Oh, I didn't realize that. It is.
Linda Anderson is that's been the director for, I did it for 6 years, and she's done it since then. And I went over a couple of years ago to help them make applesauce, and it was fun. And she says it's going real well, but now all the people that work at the camp had been campers, so they know exactly how it works. You know, it just is a perpetuating machine now.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I think it has been important in some lives.
What kinds of programs did you have there?
Oh, we had themes. Like one year it was You Can Make a Difference. Once it was about disability in some way, you know, an inclusion kind of thing. So, you know, we'd have some content relevant to the theme, and we'd have, we were able, you know, to get quite a good musicians to come, and because they were, people knew them, and they were, the thing I remember, the director of Highland was Hubert Sapp, and his wife was Jane Sapp. They're African American people. And she was a piano player and a singer. And and she led us all in this song that goes, Lucy is so beautiful, Lucy is so beautiful, Lucy is so beautiful, and it's so beautiful, beautiful to be Lucy. And so you sing this all around the room, you know, so it's, you know, there certainly are many affirming experiences like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are a lot of fun things, like swimming and a water slide down the hill at Highlander, and, you know, so those things I think have continued. And now I understand that they've added a few things like playing tricks on each other at night. We did never do that. But it'd be fun to talk to the young people who went to it about how, well, Beth Usselton, there was a little deal at Highlander last year because it was his 25th year, and Beth spoke about how it was important to her.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nice.
Yeah, I hear she's an activist.
Right,
herself
she
now.
Is. She is.
So is your impression that a lot of the kids involved then had, became more active as they came of age? I mean, was that one of the goals?
Well, it was a goal to open people to all these issues and things. I don't know about being an activist.
Mm-hmm.
There were some offspring of activists there. You
mm-hmm.
know, some civil rights people's offspring were there. That was neat. But no, it was a goal to expose kids definitely to that kind of thinking,
mm-hmm.
and I think it still is.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, I think some of those experiences are more available other places now than they were in, you know, 1982 or whenever it was happening.
Mm-hmm. So did that happen in conjunction with Highlander becoming more kid-friendly in general?
Probably. Because some people there started having some children, and I had worked there doing childcare, and I had this idea that we should offer childcare there that had some relevance to what was going on in the adults' meetings.
Mm-hmm. And that's come up a lot with other interviewees as an important point in mm-hmm. Highlander's history.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was.
Mm-hmm. So what was your, can you talk about your involvement in that.
Well,
how it happened, because I know it wasn't exactly.
Well, I think it must have been when John Gaventa was the director, and you know, he certainly was open to things. And I mean, I guess I was needing work, and it was easier to work on weekends. I could take the children if I needed to. And, you know, basically I would try to find out what it is, the issues they were talking about in there, you know, what group was meeting and all, and then try to think of ways to help the kids think about some of those same things. Hmm. And, you know, sometimes we could, you know, make something to present or something that related, and that would be the best. It was hard to do, and that you never knew what children you were going to have, what ages you were going to have, all that. You know, it was a little bit unpredictable. So mm-hmm. it wasn't perfect, mm-hmm. but it was a good idea. And they certainly were open to it at that point. At that point, we were meeting still. When I first started, anyway, they were. There was a trailer behind the old house, which was the office, and that was where the childcare was.
So did the idea of bringing childcare to Highlander stem from the mothers' meetings?
I don't know. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, it would be interesting if somebody knows how that started. So you think they didn't even offer childcare before then? Mm-hmm.
From what everyone else says,
wow.
No. And
wow.
Bingham Graves thought that once childcare was offered, more women started coming to the meetings.
Wow.
And because okay. Now, like Susan Williams, when she talks about the workshops, she talks about how it's mostly women.
I see.
So I'd asked Bingham wow. if that had always been the case, and she said, no, I think the childcare was crucial.
Wow. Well, that would make every sense in the world.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you okay. didn't even know, but...
I didn't know. I didn't know how important it was. Oh, it's neat.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine it had a big impact on the kids, given
right.
that you were talking to them about important things, and not just babysitting, it sounds like.
Right, right. I'll have to ask somebody if they had it before I went there. Golly. I'll tell you something. It is frustrating that you can't remember as much as you want to.
Well, if we get enough stories, we can piece them together
and
work it out. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Well, I guess earlier, before we started recording, you had mentioned how feminism, or the women's movement, was particularly important for the way you've raised your children and more personal things like that. When we were talking about the difference between people's professional lives and personal lives. Do you want to say a little bit more about what exactly that meant for you?
Oh, well, I mean, partly it was growing up here, so you grew up in Knoxville, and what part of Knoxville did you grow up in?
I grew up in Corryton.
Well, it's probably real similar to Seymour, I bet, in that the general culture is pretty basic Tennessee.
And so I think, you know, we, and very many respects, we had to provide, or felt it was good to provide kind of alternate models for our children to what they encountered at school. But at the same time, I think they both feel, and I feel, that it was good for them to go to the schools here and learn to know different kinds of people. I mean, it, in a way, they both went on to college, to Swarthmore and to Oberlin, and where they met people who, you know, some of whom had gone to exclusive schools where they didn't meet the rank and file kind of person. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I think partly, of course, we valued, we wanted them to value the people here and to see the good, you know, what is good. And but at the same time, we wanted them to have other, to know there were other ways of being, in which we, you know, we provided through the Highlander camp, or we provided through movies we went to, or books we read, or, you know, whatever. And then when Susanna was a teenager, she chose to go to the Unitarian youth group because it was good for her to have another reference group. And so I think all those things helped. And as far as what, so I think basically that is how I would think of it affected their lives. It was, it, I mean, it certainly was partly, you know, through what we provided them that way. Mm-hmm. Now, when they were in the second grade, Rachel had a teacher who did the Free to Be You and Me curriculum, you know, so some things happened there, you know, which was neat.
So you sent them to the public school?
Yeah, they went to the public school here. Yeah. Now, that's what I did. You know, I had went to a little public school, and I kind of had a little resentment, I think, at not knowing. I felt I didn't know how much I didn't know when I went to Oberlin. You know, it was a shock to me. So I think I resented a little bit my parents not recognizing that. That was a little bit of a lack. Mm-hmm. I think when, you know, the schools here, it wasn't, they were better, and that they had some AP classes, and they both went to governor schools, and, you know, so there were some influences that helped them.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Were there ever conflicts with educators?
I don't think so. Not that we went and harangued people about.
Mm-hmm. What are your daughters doing now?
Well, Rachel is, she became a teacher, and she went to Bank Street. She is not teaching now. She has two children, and she lives in Washington, D.C., and her husband works for National Public Radio. And she's good. She's doing well. Susanna lives in the British Virgin Islands. She saw an ad upon graduating from college to work on a paper. She had worked on the Oberlin paper, although she hadn't studied journalism. She'd worked on it a lot. Was interested in it, so she went to this job, and then so that's been 10 years now. And she ended up marrying somebody there.
Mm-hmm. So we're stuck with her being there. She's working for a couple of papers, finally being the editor of a paper. But then got a job with the government, and then got a job with a law firm. She's being a communications person for this mm-hmm. law firm. So she seems okay, but she seems far away.
Mm-hmm.
Be interesting for you to ask those two people a couple of questions.
I know. I know. I keep thinking that now. I met one of Bingham's daughters the other night, and Marcia mentioned that I should talk to her daughter too. Uh-huh. And I think it's a good idea to
have
a different perspective. So I guess my last question, and then I'll see if there's anything you want to add, is kind of a broad question that about this research project we're working on, and that is, how would you describe Southern feminism? Or, I mean, do you think that that's a useful term or phrase for us to be using?
Mm. So this is opposed to other kinds of feminism in some way, or you assume that it?
Yeah, and I think part of it, well, a large part of it comes from that feminism has often been defined from people in northeastern cities or places like Chicago, where there were consciousness-raising groups and people began to define second wave feminism or the women's movement in very particular mm-hmm. ways. Mm-hmm. And we have this feeling that it doesn't really work here. So we're trying to get a handle on what mm-hmm. what it is, or what ideas people had about it.
I see.
So that's
well,
why
I don't know. I think it's a good idea. I think it's true, and I think it could be thought of as more practical and less philosophical.
Hmm.
I think, you know, a lot of people have done work that is with real people, and they're not they're more complicated, you know, than someone's theory. So I think that, and I think it's very useful to be practical. But it doesn't. It may not write the big book, you know. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of an example of when you felt like there were feminist impulses driving some of the things you were doing, but it was based on practical outcomes rather than being a part of the women's liberation movement?
Well, there's, there's being a Girl Scout leader, mm-hmm. which I was for some years. And mm-hmm. there's, you know, so trying in some way to make kids feel strong, young girls feel strong, and which is a simple but important thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, it's kind of doing things where you are in a smaller way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But still is significant, but is not a real big thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And what was the work you've been doing for the past few years?
I did. I worked for TIPS, which is Tennessee Infant Parent Services, which I would be a parent advisor and would go to a home with a child for a child that mostly had some disability or some language problem, or they could have a hearing or speech impairment, although I wasn't qualified to do that. So I did this for maybe four years after I worked for an agency that was a drug counseling agency for about 10 years. So this was similar to that job I did early on, where I visited people in their homes and tried to empower them, help them be better parents. Have to say, it was hard. It was interesting to do, but hard to feel like you were really doing that, really accomplishing that, because number one, they had so many reasons they couldn't be doing a good job, or some of them were doing a good job without you, and that's good. Or they just turned it over to you, basically, to entertain their child for an hour, and then that's the most frustrating. But Polly, if you should talk to Polly, she does this job now still.
Well, is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, it's been a good life, and it's been nice for me to think about it. So thanks.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.